This is File 28, Cycle 3. This is Jean McMillan. Today's date is March 27th, 2018. I am interviewing Dan Olagnani, who is going to talk about his time at the Interlaken Inn when he was Director of Marketing and Sales. But first, we'll start with the genealogical information. What is your name?
My name's Dan Bolognani, and I live in Lakeville.
Oh, good. And your birth date?
October 1, 59.
And your birthplace?
North Adams, Mass.
And your parents' names?
Jim and Betty Bolognani.
And her maiden name was Whitney?
Yes.
Okay. And you have a lot of siblings.
I do.
You do?
I'm one of 11 children.
All right. Can you name them?
Sue, Nancy, Anna, Lee, Cindy, John, Dan, Ted, Tim, Judy, and Heidi.
All right. Cindy came between Lee and...
John.
John.
Mm-hmm.
You, Ted.
Tim.
Tim.
Then Judy.
Judy.
And Heidi.
And Heidi.
Mm-hmm.
And your parents were in the hospitality trade, were they not?
They were. They were innkeepers and business people in southern Vermont, where I was born and raised. Well...
You weren't born, but you were raised.
Born just over the border in North Adams. That is the closest hospital to our hometown.
It would be. It would be. And you worked in a variety of places before you came to the Interlaken.
Yes.
You worked at the Harrison Conference Center in Southbury?
In Southbury, yes.
You worked at Arrowwood in Westchester County, New York?
Yes, that's right.
And then you came to the Interlaken.
I did.
All right. What year did you come to the Interlaken?
I did. I had a little hiatus in between where I had moved back to Vermont and became an innkeeper at the family business for about 5 or 6 years. And then moved back into the area here and had a brief stint with the Berkshire School.
Oh, good.
Running environmental services for that fine entity. And had a chance meeting with the general manager at the Interlaken, Kevin, who was a good friend for many years past.
Lovely man.
While I was working at the Berkshire School, and he invited me to rejoin, and that was 1997 is my closest recollection.
Wonderful. You'd worked with Kevin before?
Yes, at both the Harrison in Southbury and at Arrowwood in just outside of White Plains.
Now, Kevin was the general manager before or after Maggie and Bob Schlegel?
After. That's
okay.
Right. Yeah. Bob and Maggie had hired Kevin as the operations manager at the Interlaken. And when Bob and Maggie moved on, Kevin assumed the role of general manager there.
Now, who owns the Interlaken?
That is a family, the Reisman family. The primary is Paul Reisman. But I understand that his brother Stephen and perhaps one or two other people have small equity positions with the Interlaken. But Paul really is the owner of the inn.
And they're from New Jersey?
They are, yes.
Okay. Yep. And they bought it from the Peters family?
That's right.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. In reading an article about the Interlaken, or the timeline that Kevin sent me, there was a bed and breakfast on the spot in 1790.
Yeah, there's quite a history there.
Yes. Quite a history.
And you know, there was a good hospitality trade back then, you know, with the iron industry that was here.
Oh, yes.
And people coming and going. And, of course, the overland shipping route to get some of the heavier weight iron finished products, for instance, train wheels, had to be shipped overland to the Hudson River at Poughkeepsie in order to be shipped out. And I suspect those... a lot of the transit that was happening then required a lot of hospitality place to stay and get a hot meal.
Yep. And a drink or two.
And a drink or two.
Oh,
no
yes.
No doubt.
Absolutely. Who actually hired you?
Kevin.
Kevin did.
Kevin Bousquet, general manager at the time.
And what were you hired for?
Initially, operations there. And in operations at the Interlaken means generally front office... You know, the front desk and the front office, the reservations department, the housekeeping department, and the maintenance department, you know, that oversees the grounds and the physical structures.
There's a lot there.
Maintaining all of that. Food and beverage, you know, the dining room and the banquet was separate. That had its own set of managers.
All right, if you came in 97, then the inn looks then as it does now.
It does.
Okay.
That is correct. With the modern buildings, with the townhouses in the back, the only original buildings, of course, were the Sunnyside House, which is what the only original building standing, and that's the big Victorian house at the back of the property. And, of course, the English Tudor House, which was the Peter's residence, was my understanding at one time.
It was. Okay.
But essentially, the inn was as you see it now. When I joined the team in '97, you know, people on staff there, which many people wouldn't know here in town. Of course, Kevin Bousquet is general manager. Mona Staff Hoffman was director of sales and marketing at that time.
Oh, she was.
Yes.
Okay. I asked her for an interview, and she said no. I said okay. Well, I wanted her for the bank.
Yeah.
I remember when she was at the Interlaken, I wanted her for the bank, and she said, no, you have to do John Parati and tell him I said so. Okay. You were marketing and sales.
That's right. Eventually, as you know, people had come and gone and positions shifted there, I gravitated toward what I knew best, which was you know, the sales and marketing end, and in particular, I enjoyed the technology and the rise of the digital age, you know, internet marketing and online advertising and whatnot. And it was,
you really liked that,
didn't
you?
It had a great appeal for me, and so I gravitated toward that department.
Oh, okay. Because originally it was telephone and letters.
Yeah, and printed brochures and newspaper advertising,
okay,
and some limited magazine advertising, some limited radio, and that's really, really shifted in the past two decades.
Yes, it has.
Yeah.
And you still like the digital part of it.
I do. I enjoy the heck out of it, and in particular, analytics.
Oh, good.
Analytics and looking at how consumers search and how they make buying choices.
Oh, you like the statistics.
I do. I'm a statistics and an analytics guy.
Oh, good. Well, we need that.
Yeah.
We need that to know how things are going.
Yeah.
Do you feel that with the digital age you've got a wider market?
It leveled the playing field because I think, you know, the larger, more established hotels back in the paper age had a serious advantage in that they could afford much more advertising. They had more advertising power. They could buy radio and television and newspaper and do you know, direct mail, all of which were very expensive.
Yeah.
And it put a small property like the Interlaken at a serious disadvantage.
It would. It would.
You know, in the dawn of the digital age, leveled the playing field much more in that it was much more tactical. And online advertising, if done right, is much more cost efficient.
Oh, good.
And so I think it helped us reach new markets in a much more efficient way. And, you know, markets changed for the Interlaken over time. You know, the rise and fall of competing lodging properties and competing restaurants, they all shift the landscape. You know, the change of businesses that are located nearby, the change in leisure travel patterns, and then niche markets like weddings and anniversary parties and these sorts of things that the inn was able to take advantage of over time. So, you know, as the landscape shifted...
You shifted with it.
We had to shift with it or risk losing our market share.
Sure. When did the resort focus come in to the Interlaken?
You know, I think the resort focus had been there for many, many decades prior to my joining the team there.
Okay.
And looking back at some of the anecdotal evidence of when the Interlaken was the summer resort for New Yorkers to come and get out in the country... In fact, we still enjoyed having some of our summer patrons who would come and stay with us for weeks and months on end.
Yes, I worked at one of those.
And it was the resort flavor of the Interlaken had persisted, to my understanding, for many decades, probably close to 100 years. And we tried to maintain that same flavor with, you know, the tennis courts and the swimming pool and the lakefront with the canoes, mm-hmm. and a generally leisurely feel to the property. Lots of nice gardens and lawns and places to sit and relax outdoors. Restaurant that was open more or less 7 days a week, mm-hmm. breakfast, lunch, mm-hmm. and dinner. So you could actually come and stay at the inn and enjoy the property without ever having to leave until you left to go home. And we provided just the overall resort experience there.
I see. And it's expanded over time with the spa and the Pilates and all of this.
Right.
In order to enhance the experience.
Yes. And it was a shift in consumer demand for certain resort amenities, mm-hmm. that caused us to continue to add amenities as consumer demand shifted. Early in the 1980s, when Bob and Maggie took the property, when Paul Reisman purchased the property from the Peters family, mm-hmm. and had hired Bob and Maggie Slagle to take the role as the resident property managers, they, Bob and Maggie, came to the Interlaken with a good institutional understanding of the conference and meeting market. And it was at that point, again, my understanding is that Bob and Maggie helped to shift the Interlaken to also accommodate these markets as well. Corporate meetings, mm-hmm. business meetings for local companies, corporate outings, and this sort of thing. And they adapted the property to take advantage of that market as well. Mm-hmm. Meeting rooms, conference services, banquet buffets. And
that wasn't in the 60s and the 50s.
Right.
But it came in, in the 80s. Right. It was a hot area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the inn did very well during that period.
Okay. When did you leave the Interlaken?
Let's see. This is 2018. So it would be 2015... is at the point when I departed, and it was sad to
say
the least.
Yes, it would be.
I'd been there for 18 years at that point and saw the property evolve.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Constant evolution, and had a lot of good friends there and a lot of good memories there. It's a
wonderful
place. Yeah, it's a fine place to work at and be associated with, and I took great pride in the fact that I was part of the management team there.
So it shows.
And I really enjoyed my tenure there. The opportunity arose, a new program that was here in the region was seeking an executive director, mm-hmm. and I was super familiar with their mission and goals,
uh-huh.
and felt it was most compatible with my life at that point.
Change is good. Change is good.
It was a hard decision to leave the Interlaken,
but it
was a decision I had to make.
And it was good for you.
Very good.
Now, you've been on a lot of boards and done a lot of volunteering, so we're going to ask about that. Extras. You were on the board of Extras.
Extras, yes. It was a relatively new program in the 80s.
Late 80s, early 90s.
Yes, I joined the board there, I believe, in
92. You told me before.
Yeah, 92. And my children were at Salisbury Central School.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a father looking to get my job done and take care of my children. And the Extras program was ideal. You know, the after-school, mm-hmm. setting right there at the school. And so I was first a patron of the Extras program.
Sure.
And then was invited to join the board of Extras, and really enjoyed looking at the inside machinery of how that nonprofit was, uh-huh. operated. Took the took the chance at some point, I think, to become the treasurer and then to become the vice chair and then the chairman of Extras, and really enjoyed how much that program meant to the parents of school-aged children in town. And I saw an opportunity to lend my expertise mm-hmm. to helping that program evolve and become more relevant to the townspeople. Some excellent, excellent board members had come and gone, and I believe still continue to come and go there at Extras.
Who was on the board with you?
At that point, Patricia Williams, who's our town clerk now, Dick Tabor, Reverend Tabor from the Congregational Church, Eileen Lee, who else was with us at that time?
That's all right.
Yeah, my recollection, though, it was incredible, incredible group of people who were there solely for the benefit of children in town in making that program the best it possibly could be.
It started out, I left in 91, it started out as where the kids did homework after school, lots of kids. It's developed over the time to quite a wonderful program. But at the beginning, it was simply for keeping the kids safe and not going home to an empty house. What was the focus of the board? Was it fundraising or was it enrichment?
We sought to make the program as relevant to the parents as possible. We had tinkered with a before-school program at that point and ultimately had to abandon that and focus on the afternoon component, always seeking to make the program relevant and affordable for parents. And so, yes, part of it was fundraising, doing events and hot dog sales and raffles and bake sales and anything that we could think of at that point to raise a few dollars to help parents to offset their tuition costs. Mm-hmm. We wanted that program accessible to everybody, regardless of their ability to pay.
What was the tuition cost at that point? Do you remember?
I don't, but I recall that it was
low.
It was modest.
Yeah, it would be. It would be.
Yeah, it was modest. I don't recall exactly what it was, but still, regardless, it seemed out of reach for parents who could really have used the services, and we strove very, very hard to make it as affordable as we could.
There were a lot of children on free lunch. People don't think that, but if you're in the school, there was a lot of kids on free lunch and reduced, you know, and all of the programs that I was involved in served all of the children regardless.
Yeah.
I mean, they're kids, and they're not responsible for circumstances beyond their control.
Yeah.
And whether it was Extras or Nature's Classroom or field trips, whatever, there was always some money available to help out the parents that couldn't quite make the deadline for the food.
Well, and when you have the opportunity to join the board of a local civic organization such as Extras, you get to see the inner workings of the town, the townspeople, and it reveals the generosity of the people of Salisbury.
Absolutely. Cradle to grave.
It's amazing. And, you know, I think unless you have the opportunity to look at it from the other side to see where that because much of that generosity is anonymous.
Oh, yes.
There are people who choose not to, and they're doing it out of the goodness of their heart. And so serving on the board really was enlightening and uplifting.
Yes. The oral history and all of the things that I have done, whether it's the family services or the daycare center or Extras or SOAR or the Bissell Fund or the McChesney Fund.
Yeah.
It's amazing what this town gives for anything that they feel is needed. And there's a variety of things, new ambulance, fire department, ski jump. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. It's been an eye-opener for me to be able to do the oral history and to do so many nonprofits like the Jane Lloyd Fund. Some of the other things that I can't recall at this point, but it's an absolutely generous community that wants to nurture from cradle to grave.
Yeah, it's uplifting.
Very. It's a very wonderful, wonderful town. And each oral history that I do reinforces that. You are the town representative to the Tourist Board of Connecticut.
Yes, by state statute. Each town in Connecticut, each municipality, appoints a representative to the Regional Tourism Board. Right now, there are three such boards in the state. It's a little convoluted. There used to be 15, then 11, then 9, 7, 5, now 3. So the state is essentially divided into thirds, each one having a tourism bureau. Doesn't make entirely too much sense.
No.
Yes, I am the Salisbury appointed representative to the Regional Tourism Bureau. I've seen the regional bureau. I've been the rep for in excess of 20 years now, and
you know the area.
Soon after joining the tourism board, I became vice chairman and then chairman within 3 years or so, simply because of my connection with the Interlaken.
Sure.
My driving desire to see the best tourism marketing possible using state funding, and had some very clear ideas about how a regional tourism bureau should operate. And I guess the rest of the board recognized my drive to get that done and rapidly elected me chairman, which I continue to serve as this day, despite the fact that temporarily anyway, I believe, the state of Connecticut has defunded regional tourism. It's, I believe, a temporary situation due to budget constraints, but I continue to serve. I continue to have an interest in the tourism industry.
Well, naturally.
And, you know, in my capacity now with the National Park Service, the National Heritage Area Program, part of my mission is also to support and supplement the economic diversity in the region. And so tourism being a big part of that,
I have
a continued interest.
Sure you do.
I continue to serve.
All right. When you joined the Upper Housatonic Valley National Heritage, when did you join and what do you do?
So this program came out of the Tri-Corners History Council, of which the Salisbury Association, the Historical Society within, had a group that was very interested, working diligently to uncover and share our early iron industry, and many of those people would be familiar to people who may be listening to this recording. They had a great interest in early industry, in particular iron, and quickly realized the story can't be told simply within the confines of the town of Salisbury.
It's required,
looking beyond to the surrounding towns, even to the surrounding states, you know, adjoining New York State and Massachusetts, all had critical pieces of the bigger story of iron. And so this group, the Tri-Corners History Council, sought a solution. How can a wider net be cast to tell this story, and how can we find additional resources? I think some of the council members had heard of the National Heritage Areas. This is a program that's administered by the National Park Service. And they understood a National Heritage Area has the ability to cast a wider net for history, culture, natural resource conservation measures. And so they approached Congresswoman Nancy Johnson and asked if Congresswoman Johnson might be able to have the Park Service study the region. And that was in the year 2000. Nancy, to her credit, moved very quickly on that, and the Park Service began studying the region in 2001. It took them roughly a year and a half of interviewing people here in the area, talking to municipal leaders and history people and educators and institutions, and basically asking the question, is there a heritage of national significance here in the region? And the answer, hands down, was yes, there is. The early industries really did power early America here.
They sure did. And,
we had a significant role in that. Not only the early industries, but early village beautification and land conservation measures were identified here. Some of the earliest migration of cultural people and cultural happenings migrated into the region. There was a great deal of money that was being pumped in. In the years when we refer to as the Gilded Age, when all the Berkshire cottages, immense mansions were being built. And so the Park Service, studied the region, talked with a lot of people, answered the question, is there a heritage of national significance? Is there broad public support for this idea of a national heritage area? And is there a management entity willing and able to take on the role of administering this program locally? Mm-hmm. And the Park Service concluded yes to all three, passed that along to the Department of Interior. The bill to designate us as a national heritage area was introduced 2 years later, I believe in 2004. Failed to pass the first Congress just by lack of action. Failed to pass again in 2005. Finally, in 2006, the study was taken seriously. Congress took action, and the National Heritage Area, the Upper Housatonic Valley National Heritage Area, was born.
What are the boundaries?
It comprises 29 towns in the Housatonic River watershed, from Kent, Connecticut, to Dalton, Pittsfield, and Lanesboro in Massachusetts.
Okay, that's a big
it's
span.
It's roughly 955 square miles.
It's almost as big as my DAR chapter. Well, we're First Resistance DAR chapter is both northern and southern Berkshire, so we go from the Connecticut line to the Vermont line.
Yeah.
It's a big area.
It's a big area.
Beautiful, though, and wouldn't include all of the Lennox cottages and the tourist area of Stockbridge all the way down to Kent. Not so much Pittsfield, Lanesboro, Dalton area, unless you're involved with Crane Paper. And that's a different area.
Right.
But that's a big area.
It is. The early incorporators of the National Heritage Area, Ron Jones.
Oh, yes.
Principally.
Yep.
Ed Kirby.
Yep.
Tom Shachtman, from Great Barrington, Paul Ivory, and Rachel Fletcher. There were a handful of others, but very, very dedicated to getting the heritage area established and operating. I joined the board in, I'm recalling, 2002, when it was still being studied. The bill to designate had yet to be introduced, and I had a great interest in this. I was encouraged to join the board and immediately served as treasurer.
Sure.
And
but that's a good position to have.
It is. I account for every penny, and I like knowing where every penny comes from goes to, and balancing the books. But my keen interest in the regional impact, seeing the potential for this organization, quickly was elected as vice chair under Ron Jones' excellent tutelage.
Oh, he's wonderful.
And at the point when the bill to designate the heritage area had passed Congress, we were advised by the National Park Service to appoint an executive director on an interim basis, part-time basis, and so I had agreed to leave the board at that point and become its first part-time or interim executive director. And I relished the opportunity again to see the inner tinkerings, to be able to help the program chart a future course. and to help the board envision all that that organization could be for the region. It was
again, a perfect fit.
Invigorating and uplifting.
Thank you so very much. Is
My
there
pleasure.
Anything that you'd like to add before we close?
No, but thank you so much for preserving this for posterity. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you so much.